You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 53 of Tea Break Archaeology. My name is Matilda Siebrecht and today I am savouring a salted caramel black tea, which I think actually I've savoured on a lot of my other episodes now because I admit this is my go-to tea in the morning, but it is delicious. And joining me, and I've just realised I completely forgot to ask you how to pronounce your name. Let's give it a shot and see how badly I screw this up.
Go for it.
Is Katie Chinqui?
Yeah, sort of. Katie Chinqui. It's actually phonetic, but it throws people off. So
That's the problem, right? I would think, oh no, but it's one of those names that doesn't look like how it sounded. Okay. Who is an archaeologist and a science communicator? So what beverage are you drinking today on your break?
I am drinking this is called Elpenglow. Oh. This is apropos because this was actually gifted to me by a skincare brand, but I think it's like chamomile, holy basil, rose, lemon balmy, kind of cozy stuff.
But like floral, sort of florally herbal. Nice. Yeah,
Floral. It's heavy on the chamomile.
Oh, okay. You're not the sort, because are you like my husband who whenever I try to offer him one of my like nice rose green teas, he's like, no, I don't want to drink soap.
Yeah, no, I can't do like too much. Although I do like a pure jasmine, like a real jasmine is really good.
Okay. And are you a tea drinker in general?
I'm a coffee drinker in the morning. I have a very large cup of coffee in the morning. And then I switch to tea to just be responsible, you know?
Yeah. That's fair. I never used to, my listeners have heard this all before, so apologize if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, but like, yeah, I never used to drink coffee. And then at some point, weirdly, around the birth of my second child, I started drinking coffee more. I would have indeed my one coffee in the morning. But
yeah, it's necessary.
It's one of those things. Although for me, at least the coffee, it has to taste as least like coffee as possible in order for me to drink it. So I'm the one who goes for the like white chocolate mocha, blah, blah, blah. And you know, when I was in Italy last week and I felt so awful because I was just drinking tea the whole time because I was like, I can't ask for a caramel latte and anything like that. No. But then on the one of the last days, I was in a little cafe with some of my colleagues, and on the menu it said like espresso and you can add a syrup like vanilla or, you know, caramel. And I was like, oh, perfect. They do that in this one then. So I said, oh, can I get a latte with caramel? She sort of said, with caramel? Okay. I went, brought it back. It was delicious. But yeah.
Oh, good.
Like, okay. Never mind. I've ruined
my how embarrassing.
But oh, well, you're joining me here on my tea break. And I mean, do you work from home? Do you work in the office? How often do you have kind of breaks throughout the day?
I work from home. Don't have any breaks. My boss is just really intense and just doesn't, I get no breaks. I have to work all the time. He's very energetic. He's 2 years old.
Very demanding. Yeah. No. So,
yeah. No breaks. No breaks. But we have a lot of fun. So there's some fun involved.
Yeah. Have you seen that? There's some ad, I think, for like some cold medication. And it's someone opening the door and being like, hi, Helen. No, I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to call in sick today. I just can't work. And you look into the room and there's a little 2 year old. Like, yeah, unfortunately. So.
Perfect.
You are not looking after energetic 2 year olds. What do you do with the rest of your life?
Yeah, I mean, so I run multiple platforms under the handle of Indiana.Joan. Clever. And that takes up the vast majority of my time. It just started growing. And my largest platform is actually Shahongshu, also known as Red Note, which is a huge Chinese app. And I have no idea why that became like my biggest platform. I have no idea why, but like I have the most amazing like followers in China who are so supportive and engaging. And a lot of them are actually from the States as well. It's a really global,
I was about to say, do you speak Chinese? Do you have Chinese heritage? Like, because I know this is a stereotype, but I must admit, looking at you, I would not have expected.
Right. I'm not Chinese. Okay. Actually, my last name, Chinqui, is my married name, which is China. I mean, you would never look at my husband and think that he's Chinese either. So that's a long story there. But I don't speak Mandarin whatsoever. But thanks to the magic of translation, I spend a lot of time like going line by line and translating it into Mandarin. And I kind of feel like I started this and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so much work. But like, they're really so great. Like, my apologies are so great. Yeah.
But also, even if you go line by line, because Mandarin is so, there's so many, all the nuances and everything. Like,
yeah, I mean, this is what AI should be used for. This is the kind of things to use. A Google Translate fails pretty fantastically in this. But if you give AI, this is the phrase, but this is also what I'm trying to capture. It actually does. It's not perfect. A human is still better by a long stretch. Yeah. But for someone who is trying to communicate, oftentimes very nuanced things that you want to be careful about, especially like my embodiment, anything that's sort of about the human body, like I want to be very careful about translating that. And I did this post that really blew up over on that platform that was about estimating biological sex, because I also have a degree in bioarchaeology and paleopathology. And I did not use AI for that. I used Google Translate. This is not promoting AI use. However, it is really useful for some translation things.
Yeah.
But I, yeah, so obviously I didn't use that. And I was doing estimating. My first line in there, I think, was like, let's talk about biological sex. And boy, oh boy, did that blow up, because it was not the right word for like sex as in like chromosomal.
Yeah.
And then I think people like,
let's talk about sex, baby.
I mean, yeah, it was really, however, I will say like so many comments were like, I came for this sensationalism and I stayed for this content. And I gained like, I don't know, 10,000 followers or something like that. So I mean, and they've stayed. So obviously it wasn't just salacious. Salacious.
Okay. And what's the like sort of general content? Because I know you from Instagram. I follow you on Instagram mainly. And I remember, I think what first got you into my algorithm was your archaeology 101 little sort of
series
videos. But is that sort of the general vibe, or do you more specialized?
I mean, so I cover a lot of things. Actually, all of the platforms started as an archaeology of beauty platform. So, but then there were some things that were happening and some things that I was sort of reading about that I really wanted to talk about. The biological sex thing, I'm not going to go into politics here, but there is a whole bunch of things going on in the world that where we're talking about biological sex. And I was like, you know what, as a former nurse practitioner, which I'm sure we'll get into, and someone who has a degree in human bioarchaeology, I think I'm going to weigh in here. So then I started really branching out a little more into other things. But that really is sort of like my pet passion is ancient self-care practices, which is absolutely a retroactive term. I don't think people were using the term self-care whatsoever. No, but I'm
they weren't doing little beauty videos in ancient Greece. Like,
they were definitely doing beauty practices. Well, we can get into that. But I'm interested in skincare and cosmetics and scent, hugely interested in scent and fragrance. Absolutely like could read about that forever. Just it's there's a and there's also just a lot of things happening in that space, and I just think it just shows, it just reveals so much about what people valued and what people were doing on a daily basis, and also a lot about materials and trade and sort of relationships between different groups of people. So yeah, that's my pet project. So I've been doing these, and there are more plans, so stay tuned. But I've been doing these sort of ancient skincare recreation, this experimental archaeology side, which has been super fun. So yeah, that's the nutshell, I think.
Okay, yeah, nice. And but then, so far we've got paleopathologist, archaeobiologist, nurse, mom, of course, like, and then all the, so talk us through it. How did it start? How did it get into skincare?
Yeah, well, it's even more complicated. My undergraduate degree is in international relations.
There's another loop.
I think it's safe to say, like, at the end of the day, what you could call me professionally is just student. I think that is probably the most
student
accurate.
Student of life, yeah.
Or life of life. Also poor because of that. So
because of aforementioned student, yeah.
Yeah, so, but first degree was that. When I was studying abroad in Central America, I really was like, you know what, I really need a skill. And I was with a lot of midwives at the time, and I sort of went down that route. Then once I started school, once I started nurse practitioner school, I realized that I sort of wanted a little bit more than just midwifery, just that really mm-hmm. narrow lane. And so I became a women's health nurse practitioner, an adult nurse practitioner, and then I did that for 13 years in the States. Wow. And I worked in a lot of different areas and populations. My first job was on the Navajo Nation reservation. That's in sort of Arizona, Four Corners, Arizona. Phenomenal archaeology down there.
I can imagine.
Yeah, like absolutely incredible stuff. But really, my actual passion is history. I mean, that, and it has been like forever. I was a total American Girl doll. That's a whole subculture. There are these like dolls that came out in, I think, the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, and they focus on like different historical sort of time periods.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. And there is like a subculture of us who like grew up on these.
Okay. Because I thought I'd heard of these, but I guess in my mind they were more like sort of Barbie. Like,
no, they're
like Barbie. Surgeon Barbie.
No. Extremely. Now, Mattel bought them later on, but in the early days, it was this tiny company and they had six books that they were accompanied with. And they were all, these were very well researched. Okay. And so it really highlights these different time, American Revolution and sort of Emancipation okay. Proclamation and all these different sort of like time periods in the American. So this has been, this has really been who I am for a really long time.
I think that's the first time I've heard American Girl doll as being the inspiration to get into a career in archaeology.
Yeah.
We've had, you know, Egyptology, Indiana Jones, just being interested in old castles. It's the first time I've heard of American Girl doll. As
I could easily do like 10 podcasts on American Girl dolls. Like it's
looking for new series on the APN.
It is a subculture, I'm telling you. So yeah, so then I think for just a really long time, I was trying to figure out how do I exit this very stable career and go into this really unstable career. I'm really looking forward to this. So yeah. And then during COVID, so many people, it just kind of became clear that this is why I'm just called to do this. I mean, this is just what I'm thinking about all the time. This is what I want to do. This is who I am. And yeah, so I was kind of looking in the art history realm for a while, but as a nurse practitioner, I was very procedural, so very hands-on. Mm. And I really liked that part of it. That was my favorite part of practicing, was really doing sort of procedures. Mm. And so I think archaeology was, I mean, who doesn't like archaeology? Just sort of the concept of it. It's very sort of romanticized. Yeah. And then, but I thought that just really fit me a lot better, sort of the having a tangible part of history, that there's certain tactile parts there. Yeah. And I made the right decision. I've never looked back.
Amazing.
So then there was a couple steps in between there. So I was living in LA at the time and then moved my whole family to Durham and got an MA in archaeology. Then got an MSc in human bioarchaeology and paleopathology. And then I was pregnant for that entire degree, the second one. And then I graduated when my baby was like, I don't know, 2 months or something. And I was like, all right, well, I can't apply for job. Like, what am I going to do here? So that's when I started my platforms. And that has really, just brought me a lot of joy. I mean, it's been, I sort of love that I get to do and talk about and explore whatever topic that I want. The algorithm doesn't necessarily love that. They like you to niche down, but... Say lovey.
But that's really interesting. And did you find that your background in sort of nursing and the kind of medical side has that's what made you go more towards the bioarchaeology, paleopathology,
Or was it? I mean, yes, I think that felt like a natural progression. And then when I was in it, I was like, you know what? This actually is not for me at all. Like, I was just like, this is a little too similar to what I was doing. Before, it's a lot of memorization heavy. There's like loads of critical thinking as well, but it's in a very different way. It's a very sort of structured way. And I just, if this makes me simple, then so be it. But I love sort of the tombs, temples, treasure, I mean, like this is like my dissertation was on the goddess Cybele, however you want to pronounce it. And I absolutely loved writing that dissertation. That was, I just, ooh, every minute of that dissertation. Who says that?
No, but I mean, well, I mean, that's indeed the joy, right? That's why we get into this particular topic. I'm curious, who is, I mean, sort of elevator pitch, who is the goddess Belly? I have not heard of her.
Oh, okay. So this is, well, she's considered a Greco-Roman goddess, but actually she's from Anatolia. So this is really sort of much, much earlier. She was under the name Matar, in which just means mother. That was in the Phrygian Highlands. And I mean, we can, you can stop me when you want to stop me here.
We can read the thesis as well, but like, I'm just curious.
You want a good name?
Why should we know about her? What's so interesting about her?
I mean, I think that she, well, first of all, what's interesting about her is that she's considered a mother goddess, has no kids. So very different than like Rhea, Hera kind of. Yeah, she has zero children. She is really a protector of cities. And that's why she was sort of brought to these other two. She started to move west into, right, into the Greco world, the Greek speaking world.
Classical world, yeah. Okay.
And then Rome, like, actually physically brought her to, like, they, there's like this sacred rock that they brought to Rome. Nice. And she's super interesting. I mean, it sort of goes with sort of what I'm interested in, this sort of embodiment in the ancient past, which is her priests in Rome were trans, at least cross-dressing, probably trans. Mm-hmm. There was also self-castration that was involved in the myth and in the followers. So yeah, she had, I think she had followers of men and women, but it was a lot of men.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so it's sort of the inverse of the Dionysian. Yeah. And it was a mystery cult. There's going to be a post on her relatively soon.
Excellent. But. Oh, look forward to it. Well, and I'll put some things in the show notes in case people want to read up a bit more about it as well. But I think for now we're going to take a very quick break to top up our tea because I'm nearly done with my cup, but we will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope that the teacups are fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So I didn't get Katie here today just to talk about ancient goddesses and things like that. We actually wanted to talk a little bit about a topic that we've already mentioned briefly, which is ancient self-care, which is inspired by a video that I saw on your Instagram as well, where you were doing experimental archaeology and pasting things on your face and things like that. So this is a very specific topic, and we've talked about your very twisty, turny, windy path into the field of archaeology, but how did this particular kind of subtopic first emerge?
Yeah, I love skincare. I'm a maximalist. Like, I love products. I love yapping about skincare. It's makeup, not so much. I'm interested in makeup in the ancient past because that really has there are a lot of really specific things with that, particularly in sort of identity and communicating certain things. But I think I started to look, you know, as a nurse practitioner, I was a women's health nurse practitioner, and a lot of what I did was contraceptive care. And, you know, I think when you've done these other things in your life, then the natural thing is to ask, like, well, did ancient people do this as well? And the answer is, of course, people are people. And so I think I just started asking those kinds of questions and pulling out that thread, especially because I was interested in fragrance anyway. And all these things are sort of they're in a similar academic scholarly realm, although there's some issues with that as well.
Yeah. And so in terms of sort of self-care and things like that, I mean, you mentioned it's one of those things that I guess people always, which I am always against anyway. I mean, I'm more of a prehistorian personally, and everyone's always saying, oh yes, but they were just hunting all the time and just trying to survive. And I'm like, well,
no,
like, because actually we have loads of really nice art and like loads of really cool things. How back are you going sort of with your particular research in this respect?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think that you've sort of identified one of the main issues when studying ancient skincare. So the issue is that we have a really hard time categorizing this. And of course, archaeologists love typologies and categorizing.
Yeah,
and so
putting things in boxes, not just artifacts, but terminology.
Yeah. So that, like, skincare really resists that. It sort of sits in the middle of this Venn diagram of beauty and medicine. And So that kind of ambiguity has historically made that really difficult to study and to find. Now, I will say there is a body of scholarly research on this, but it is often made by dermatologists, or it's often made by people who are in, they're looking, or chemists, because they're looking at ingredients. From an archaeological, so it's not that it's completely unstudied. It is understudied in general. And then from an archaeological perspective, from the archaeological discipline, it is vastly understudied. There's a lot of room there. There's definitely been some work, but there's a lot of room.
Is that because of just the bias of who's been studying it, or is it because of the evidence that's available?
Yeah, I mean, perfect question. This is skincare is, I mean, people are probably even thinking this right now. Skincare is often dismissed as trivial and that it's not serious archaeology, but I think it absolutely is worth asking why we think that. And a significant part of that answer is that in the modern Western imagination, skincare and cosmetics are seen as very feminine, as sort of, this sort of trivial frivolity. And that actually ties in greatly with where some of our sources are for skincare, which is Rome and the sort of very complicated and deeply ambivalent relationship that ancient Rome had with beauty. And so these things are sort of all tied together. But again, you just going back to like your original question about the how far back are we looking? I think that the issue there is, are we talking about skincare as ritual and self-care, or are you talking about skincare as a dermatological practice and you know, medicine? So I know you've studied, I think you studied Paleo Inuit for your PhD. So I mean, we have evidence that Inuit have used, you know, things like adipose tissue, fat tissue from seals and things on their skin to protect from the elements, you know, that that's in the Arctic. So, so people have been putting things on their skin since the beginning of time. And that is usually what we would categorize, you know, medicinally, but then it gets very complicated. You know, we have sunscreen today that's high, that's been formulated, you know, it's marketed in at Sephora and Ulta and Boots and, you know, all these things. So, but it's the same concept there. There's also, I mean, there's so many ingredients today that we can't quite figure out where that goes. Retinol is a really great ingredient. That's people use it for wrinkles and texture and all these things, but it's also prescribed in an office for cystic acne. So you can get it over the counter as sort of a cosmetic substance, and then you can get it prescribed for a condition. So we have a very hard time categorizing this. And then also because this is seen as sort of girly, which I want to be very clear here that in ancient context, the use of some sort of skin preparation was absolutely not gendered. And a lot of the evidence that we have is actually from, you know, male tombs, and people were, you know, this was makeup, skincare, scent. These things were not gendered. We have a lot, we have a significant amount of evidence for that. Yeah. So,
but indeed, I can imagine that's such a hard thing, because also there's all these jokes, right, that about, especially for like mothers and stuff. And it's like, oh, practice self-care, give yourself a shower. And the moms are going, no, that's basic hygiene. Like, that's not self-care. Like, and things. And I suppose there's all of these things now about self-care and skincare, and they're so interrelated. But like you were saying, so many of it actually does have practical benefits. Oh, yeah. It's not just to make us feel better. It's like, no, it's actually to improve in some way, something. Kind of degradation, which,
I mean, people forget, like, your skin is your largest organ that you have on your body. So, I mean, like, this
I have had that in pub quizzes before. And everyone's giggling behind their hands.
I mean, this is, it's an important part of who we are. And that is not a modern concept. This is, this has been here forever.
And do we see it all at some point, like a kind of shift in perception of something like skincare, for example, as more cosmetic rather than more health benefits? Like, is there a point in history?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if that has been, I don't know that personally, but to my idea, this is very sort of like 1950s, actually.
Yeah, okay, really.
So very recent, very recent. Yeah, and that's with you know, 1950s, one of the very first products that came out was a cold cream, and that was for cleansing, you know, and that was to take off like your makeup and everything. But the first cold cream was invented by Galen. So, I mean, this is, none of these things are new. None of these ingredients are new. It's just how we think about it and how we approach it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. That's just so many things. I'm finding out how recent these concepts are.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, it's one of the, it's what, and that's again, something that I always tell people, like the first thing of archaeology is you have to like forget everything you know about modern day things and try not to think about it. But it's so difficult because we're just in that modern day. Like it's such a natural part of who we are.
And of course, I mean, this is, there have been concepts of beauty and people trying to refine their beauty for a really long time, but really sort of that, the modern industry, I would say, the industrial complex that is the beauty world, I would say, is more this superbly recent. And when I say industry, like 2025, the beauty industry was worth like, I think between 125 and 155 billion pounds. So, but that, you know, didn't just pop up out of nowhere. This has been growing. And again, cosmetics, when you look at cosmetics, that is a much longer. Actually, Jill Burke has been doing it, has done some really great research on that. She looks at like Renaissance. So it's been around. It's been around. But when you talk about that shift from beautification into self-care and ritual, then but it's a bit, it's a bit of a full circle.
Yeah. And you mentioned like fragrance is also another kind of aspect of this idea of pampering is a modern term, but you know, let's go with that. That you're sort of looking at, is that similar in terms of sort of skincare, that it's more from the commercial aspect that it's researched rather than from the archaeological, or is that more developed?
No, so scent has, and fragrance has really been taking off archaeologically from a scholarly standpoint, like taking off. There was a huge article that came out this year that was sort of showing that Greek sculpture and Rome, Greco-Roman, to be honest, I'm not sure exactly the time that they were looking at.
I mean, you're talking to a North European historian here, so you can say anything and I'll be like, yeah, it's Mediterranean.
The safest thing to say is Greco-Roman, and then you're serving yourself.
Classical.
That the statues themselves were actually scented.
Yeah. Interesting, because I've seen that they were painted. I know that they were painted, but they were scented even.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the other thing is that this is ironically, even though that this is seen as very trivial and sort of frivolous, at the same time, this is deeply scientific, hard science. So to study skincare in the ancient past, to study cosmetics and to study fragrance, you have to be an excellent chemist. So one of the really awesome things that some archaeologists have taken a look at out of China, actually Shaanxi province, is they found a 2,700-year-old ancient face cream. It was in a man's tomb. Wow. And I may or may not be recreating that at some point. But yeah, I mean, you would not believe this article. You would not believe the amount of chemical, you know, testing and residue analysis that they had to do on this. It's kind of mind-blowing. So yeah, I think we need to think about this in a much different way. It's a very hard science. This is not soft science, studying fragrance and skincare. You have to really, because we have residue analysis, and that's been used a lot on fragrance, they have, actually there was in Carmona, Spain, they had found an intact Roman, like an unguentarium, a Roman perfume that they were able to look at and had like patchouli in it, which is from much far away than Spain. So, I mean, every single time that we're able to do a residue analysis, then I think it just opens up so many things because you're like, why is this material here? And then then you start to ask questions about a much bigger narrative and it becomes a lot bigger than just like, oh, people just wanted to smell good, which that's natural. Who doesn't? You know?
But then I can imagine as well, it's so hard to, because obviously all archaeology is subjective and all interpretation is biased. But like in terms of these particular topics, things like, well, it's not even beauty because we're not talking about, like you said, we're not talking about cosmetic beauty products. We're talking about kind of, the skincare, the fragrance, those kind of things. But still, I can imagine that is a very personalized thing. How's that extra barrier in kind of interpretation and things? How is that developed? Is that something that people are starting to deal with a bit better now? Is it something that's still a big barrier to research?
Yeah, I mean, as far as like we find a substance and we're asking like, what was this used for? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, kind of, I guess. It was a very convoluted question. I think I was working out the question as I was saying it, to be honest. I guess it's more in terms of how can we actually identify that something was, I don't know, intended as a nice fragrance or something else. I mean, what is the processes that are involved in that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think this is where artifactual evidence is so important. So where, you know, place finding is really important. You know, in the classical world, it's a lot easier because the amount of material objects that we have associated with fragrance is astronomical. Okay. And this is, you know, when we say fragrance, I think people automatically think kind of perfume, but the vast majority of things that we're talking about here is incense that was used for ritual purposes, for purification, for, you know, creating some sort of experience within the temple. I mean, perfume, the word perfume is parfume, right? It's through smoke. So this is, our concept of fragrance might be a little bit off when we're thinking about it. But yeah, this is all over the world. I've mentioned the classical world a lot. That's not really fair. I mean, there are tons of incensers out of ancient China for sure. And then ancient Mesoamerica, there's, I mean, censers are one of the big finds there because they're highly decorated. We can glean a lot of information, iconographic information from them. And they were not burning frankincense or myrrh, they were burning a resin, which was known as, it's still known as copal. It can still be used today. Actually, copal is.
Okay.
So that's pretty easy, I would say, for at least archaeologically. You have an incensor, you have something that was used for incense that we know that is what that artifact is used for. You find a residue in there, you analyze the residue. Bing, bang, boom.
Yeah.
And then, but yeah, I think the skincare is a lot more complicated, but we have found like multiple intact creams sort of in various places. And it's hard to imagine what else it would have been used for other than dermatologic application. Yeah. I think that that's explored scholarly sort of in these various articles, but it is hard to imagine. Maybe that's just where our mind goes, but they contain the same ingredients that we have in modern skincare. So that does sort of
okay, then that
suggest, yeah.
God, Sephora's going crazy. They're going, look, we're thousands of years behind skincare beauty line.
Well, Sephora wants to hire me. No, I have no problem with that.
Well, and I think, so we've talked a lot about the kind of tangible things that we can find, but of course, something that you deal with a lot is the intangible. We're running out of time on this particular tea break, but if people are interested in hearing more about that, tune back in 2 weeks' time because I'm going to be chatting more with Katie about the experiments that she's been conducted and the kind of intangible ways that we can engage with the past. So come back in 2 weeks and we'll be chatting further with Katie then. In the meantime, I hope you enjoyed this brief tea break. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe, etc., wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode or all about the things that we've been talking about, you can find all of the links and the contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.